thank you so much for allowing us to be here today. My name is Janine Arbuckle. I'm one of the generalist OBGYNs at UAB. I'm going to really be talking to you guys kind of about the things that you want to think about before you get pregnant. I see that some of you might already have made that decision, and congratulations. So we'll walk through that, and then I'll hand it over to Dr. McLean in just a second. So the first thing you want to think about is, what's my plan for pregnancy? So you guys have all worked very hard in your lives to decide on what college to go to, what major to major in, what career path to take, and we want you to take that same level of interest in planning when it comes to pregnancy. So the first question is, are you ready to get pregnant? And the big thing that you want to think about is, how many children do you want to have? Do we want to have 5 kids? Because if that's so, then we might have a different trajectory than if we only have 2 kids. Similarly, you want to think, how many years do you want between your children? 5 kids with 3 years in between each other is a little bit more work, and you might want to get started now rather than waiting. And that's much different if you only want to have 2 kids and have them separated by 2 years. And then the last thing you want to think about are, what changes do I need to make to my current life to prepare me for pregnancy and being a parent? Do I need to finish school? Do I have credit cards that I want to pay off? Do we want to buy our first home together before we have children? And after doing this assessment, you may decide that we're just not quite yet ready. So we'll talk a little bit today about how to prevent pregnancy and the different mechanisms. You have both hormonal and non-hormonal options. And whatever you choose is a personal decision. In general, hormonal contraceptive is more reliable and has less failure than non-hormonal options, with the exception of the copper IUD. The copper IUD is highly effective. We do a lot of hormonal contraception at UAB, and we'll talk about each of those different options. And the important thing for you to remember is that it is safe to use hormonal contraception, and it's fully reversible. So we'll talk about kind of the different elements of each of those. So when we think about non-hormonal contraception, the first thing we think about is probably condoms, tried and true around for a long time. With perfect use, there's a 98% success rate, so only a 2% failure rate per year. The extra advantage for condoms is that it's a barrier and it prevents the transmission of sexually transmitted infections. The next thing that some people choose to use that's non-hormonal is natural family planning. And this puts a lot of onus on the woman. Basically, she listens to changes in her body that are indicative of ovulatory change. So changes in her vaginal discharge that would be reflective of a cervical mucus change, basal body temperature changes. And she maps these out from month to month, finds those days when she's likely ovulating, and then avoids intercourse on those days. More of kind of a theoretic. We don't have a good idea of how perfect this is, because I think it really depends on you having a regular cycle and having those telltale signs of ovulation. Theoretically, it has about a 5% failure risk, but it's more like probably about a 24% chance of failure to use natural family planning. The other thing that we often hear about that's non-hormonal is coitus interruptus, or the withdrawal method. The withdrawal method is really not an effective form of contraception. It also has a high failure rate of approximately 22%. We don't often recommend this amongst our patients. If you do choose to use the withdrawal method, we encourage you to accept the possibility of a pregnancy, because it does have a high rate of failure, and to take steps to make sure that if you do become pregnant, that it be a healthy pregnancy, and we'll talk about that in just a minute. Though, in general, non-hormonal contraceptives are not as reliable as hormonal options, the copper IUD is the one exception. And the copper IUD is an intrauterine device. It's placed by your doctor, and it can stay in place for 10 years. There are a lot of misconceptions about IUDs. The first is that it causes infertility, and that's not true. All the forms of contraception that we'll talk about today are fully reversible and do not impact your future fertility. And the other is that you aren't a candidate for these if you've never had children. And in reality, we can place these devices in adolescents. So they're safe, they are fully reversible. The advantage of the copper IUD is that it is non-hormonal. You'll continue to have the same cycles that you've always had, and it can last for up to 10 years. So if, when you're making that kind of reproductive life plan, you decide we are in a long-term 5 to 10 years from now, this is a great option for you. Perhaps what we use most often at UAB are hormonal contraceptives, and typically we think of combined hormonal contraceptives, so those that have estrogen and progesterone in them. And you can get these contraceptives into your body in any one of 3 ways. A pill that you take every day, a patch that you change once a week, or a vaginal ring that you change once a month. Each of these options has both estrogen and progesterone in it, and they will give the woman a regular reproductive, a regular predictable period that's both lighter and less painful than her typical period. they're 99% effective when used perfectly. There are women who these are not a good option for, those women who have a history of blood clot or stroke in their personal history, who have hypertension or have a high risk of blood clot or stroke in their family. Those women may choose to use a birth control pill that just has progesterone in it, or use a contraceptive device that's longer acting, such as the contraceptive shot. The contraceptive shot is better known as Depo-Provera. It's a shot that you get every 3 months, which is both its benefit and its downfall. So you have to come to the doctor every 3 months, but then you only have to think about it every 3 months. The advantage is that over time, women do tend to have amenorrhea or an absence of menses, and a lot of women really like that component of it. The Depo-Provera shot is fully reversible. Again, nothing that we'll talk about today causes infertility or prevents future fertility. That being said, it has the slowest return to fertility of all the agents that we'll talk about today, so it can take up to a year to return to fertility if you choose this mechanism for contraception. Similar to the contraceptive shot is the contraceptive implant. It's marketed as Nexplanon. It's basically a device that's inserted in the upper extremity, and it has a slow release of progesterone as well. So it's, again, safe in those women who have a concern about blood clot or stroke, have a history of hypertension. The advantage for this device is that it's kind of a one-and-done deal. You get it placed, and it can stay present for 3 years. So again, if we're on a long-term trajectory to family planning, that would be a good option for you. It has a similar side effect profile to Depo-Provera, and again, can end up with absence of menses, which is why a lot of women will like it. But it has a faster return to fertility. So once the device is removed, you don't see those long-standing effects of the hormone in your body. The last contraceptive that we'll talk about that has a hormonal component is the Mirena IUD. Very similar to the copper IUD, but it has a slow amount of hormone, again, a progesterone that's released slowly into the uterine environment. Again, this is a device that's placed by your practitioner. It's placed into the uterus, and it can stay there for 5 years. It prevents pregnancy in basically three ways. It changes the cervical mucus to prevent sperm from reaching the uterine cavity. If sperm do reach the uterine cavity, it changes the uterine environment so that they're less likely to stay viable. And then it changes the endometrial lining. So that lining becomes very, very thin. And as a side effect of that, women have improvement in their bleeding. So 80% of women who have this device placed will have improvement in their bleeding. Again, the same myths exist for the Mirena IUD that we see for the Paragard. We can use it amongst women who have never had pregnancies before, and it does not impact lifelong fertility. And in fact, of all the options that we've discussed, it has the fastest return to fertility of all the agents. So the most important thing to think about when you're thinking about contraception is which of these is the most reliable and which best fits with my lifestyle. In general, those that kind of are the one and done, the intrauterine device or the Nexplanon device that somebody places and you don't have to think about very often, are more effective than those that rely on you either wearing a condom every time or taking a pill every day. Now, if you've made the decision to consider a pregnancy, there are certain questions that you want to ask yourself. And the first one might be is, how will I know if it's safe to pursue pregnancy? And the answer is, see your physician. And your OBGYN is going to talk to you about your past medical history and see if there's any medical problems that might impact your likelihood of getting pregnant or having complications during your pregnancy. Things that we will specifically talk about are diabetes, hypertension, thyroid disease, if you have a history of seizure disorder. Each of those are important for your reproductive health. We'll also talk to you about any previous pregnancies. So if you had complications in prior pregnancies, have you had a prior miscarriage? Those will also impact what we do with this next pregnancy. Next, we'll also review medications that you're on, as there are certain classes that are contraindicated in pregnancy. And then we'll assess your need for vaccination. So there are certain infections that if you got during pregnancy would be much more debilitating for you and potentially threatening to the pregnancy if you were to acquire them during pregnancies, such as rubella and chickenpox. Also, if you're under the age of 26, we recommend that you receive the full Gardasil series. So the next thing that you want to think about are, what steps do I need to take now that I'm ready to pursue pregnancy? And the very first thing that you want to do even before becoming pregnant is start a prenatal vitamin. Those important events that happen even before you know you're pregnant rely on those nutrients that are in a prenatal vitamin, the most important of which is folic acid. All prenatal vitamins, you're going to see lots of commercials and flyers and coupons for certain deals. All of them will have 400 micrograms of folic acid, and that's the only thing that's been shown in randomized controlled trials to be critical to the viability of a pregnancy or the health of a pregnancy. It doesn't matter if it's CVS, Walmart, Walgreens, the generic is just fine. Next thing you want to do is optimize those medical conditions if you have them. So high blood pressure, you want to make sure that your blood pressures are in range. If you have diabetes, you want it to be well controlled. You also want to avoid alcohol, tobacco, and illicit substances. Those are contraindicated in pregnancy and can impact the health of a pregnancy. And then you want to reach and maintain a healthy body weight. Underweight women as well as overweight women show difficulties getting pregnant and then have more complications during pregnancy. The last thing that you want to think about is what's the relative health of your other family members? Are there any genetic disorders that run in my family that could impact the health of my future child? So it's not, the planning isn't, I know we've talked a lot about what the woman does, but the planning is not just for the woman, it's also for the men. Likewise, men should also be healthy. You want to optimize your physical health so that you can make sure that you're as fertile as possible. Men who have diabetes, for instance, want to make sure that their diabetes is well controlled. In addition, that same avoidance of alcohol, tobacco, and illicit substances is important, not just because of the potential exposure to the mother and the unborn child, but because it also impacts your fertility. You want to reach and maintain a healthy weight. Obese men have increased rates of infertility. And then you're half the genetic component of your future children, so knowing your family's medical history and any disorders that could be potentially inherited are important for the future pregnancy. And I think with that, we're going to turn it over to Dr. McLean.
So I'm Mamie McLean. I'm one of the assistant professors in the Division of Reproductive Endocrinology and Infertility. My specialty is a mouthful and it's really long and it's hard to get on a badge or on a coat. But besides it being long, there's a lot of misconceptions about what we do in my field and also about infertility in general. So I'd like to go over some of those with you guys today. So what do we do? So the primary thing that we do in my office is treat infertility. But we also do a lot of other things. And one of my favorite things that we do is we help patients with recurrent pregnancy loss. And a patient that I saw as a second year resident who actually had recurrent pregnancy loss is the reason that I went into my field. She was a late 20-year-old lady who'd had at least 3 late second trimester losses, and I saw her and admitted her to the OB service at about 20 weeks, so about 4 to 5 months of pregnancy with early labor. And at that point, it's too early to do anything to save the baby, and so she and her husband experienced a very painful and tragic loss of yet another of their children. And I realized that she'd had a little concern for an extra piece of tissue inside her uterus, which may have been contributing to these losses. So we got her in, did a very easy day procedure on her to remove that extra bit of tissue, and she was able to go on and deliver her child at 9 months. And so it's those simple things that we can do to help people recover from such a tragic obstetric history and go on to build their family is why I love what I do. And so in addition to recurrent pregnancy loss, we also see families or couples that have genetic conditions. So where either the couple themselves harbor genetic conditions or are carriers for genetic conditions. And these are serious problems. So things like cystic fibrosis or Huntington's, things along those lines that these couples would like to avoid to have their children affected with these tragic conditions. And so we're able to help them build their family in a way that's healthy and safe. And then fertility preservation. So for some usually single females who either haven't met the man of their dreams or for career reasons have been working in their career and haven't been able to build their family yet, we're able to help them preserve their fertility so that when they meet Prince Charming that they're able to go in and have a family with him in the future. And then we also take care of women and men who are facing gonadotoxic cancer therapies, who are faced with infertility after they go through these treatments. We're able to help them preserve their fertility as well. And pre-implantation genetic diagnosis is one of the therapies that we use to help these couples with these genetic conditions that we'll talk more about in a minute. So I like to think that most people have more tact and emotional intelligence than they actually do. But from being in my field for a number of years, these are many of the things that I've heard my patients say that they've had to deal with and struggle with in social situations. And one that I didn't put on here that I wish I had is couples having to answer the question, when are you guys going to have kids? And for a lot of them, it's, you know, gosh, well, we've actually been trying a while and we haven't been successful yet. So that's one of the common things that I hear my patients say that they have to face. Don't tell them to relax, so no amount of relaxing is going to overcome an actual infertility diagnosis. And yes, acupuncture and massage does not hurt infertility or infertility treatments, but it is simply not going to make them be able to conceive. Don't minimize the problem and don't say that there's worse things that can happen. So you guys know we all have an optimal family size. We all imagine ourselves to have children in the future. And for couples that do struggle with infertility, this is like a loss for them. And it is a hard thing that they struggle with. Another thing that just breaks my heart that I actually will have couples ask me is they'll say, does this mean that we're not meant to be parents? And that just breaks my heart because no, that is not the case at all. We have been endowed and have the ability to help you overcome infertility if you're struggling with it. So we have the knowledge and the technologies to help you build your family. It is not that you're meant not to be a parent. IVF is not the answer to everything. And yes, adoption is absolutely an option. And as part of something that we do, we often do the exams and physicals for couples who ultimately decide to adopt. That's another important part of the things that we do. But it is one of the options, but not the only option. You know, don't say that you're young and have plenty of time to get pregnant. Again, we all have in our frame of mind kind of when we want to build our family and how long that will take. Obviously, you don't gossip about your friend's condition. You don't complain about your pregnancy. That is something that is hard to do sometimes, but clearly you have been blessed with a pregnancy, and it is a very wonderful thing to be able to be pregnant. And then secondary infertility, so when couples come in because they haven't been able to have a second child, that is another frustrating condition that we see, because if it's easy to have your first and you're having trouble with your second, that is very frustrating for couples. And yes, they are lucky to have one, but again, we all have an optimal family size in our head and we shouldn't minimize that. Don't ask whose fault it is, and again, don't assume it's the female. Male infertility is actually an important component that we'll talk about. So what is infertility? The technical diagnosis is trying to conceive for 12 months without success. However, if you have a few specific conditions, it may actually be less time that is needed for you to conceive before you become labeled as infertile. So if you're older than age 35, we recommend that you just have 6 months of trying to conceive without seeking a doctor's advice, if you have known risk factors for infertility. So important male factors such as a man who has medical conditions like Dr. Arbuckle mentioned, or who had surgery in the groin as a child, or went through cancer treatment as a child. Those are things to consider. And then if women have infrequent periods or painful periods or have known endometriosis, all of those are things that make us concerned that it may actually be harder to get pregnant. And so we don't want you to go for too long trying to get pregnant on your own before you seek medical advice. Sometimes our couples say that they feel like they're the only ones struggling with infertility, or they come to church on Sunday and they're the only ones in their Sunday school class without children. But the fact is, it's about 15 to 20% of couples are diagnosed with infertility, and that's not a very small number if you think about it. And based on some fancy math that I did based on Dawson's most recent membership data, that's 510 couples at Dawson. And you look around the room and there's not many of us here. So, you know, some of your friends, some people in your Sunday school class may be struggling with this on their own, but just keep this in mind that this is not an infrequent, uncommon problem. The biggest predictor of success when you look at infertility and infertility treatments is female partner age. And that's simply because when we were inside our mothers, we were born with a certain number of eggs. And over time, those decline. No matter if you're pregnant or not pregnant or on birth control or not on birth control, those eggs go through this process of atresia regardless of what we're doing. And so you can see that per month chance of conception totally depends on age. And in your early mid-20s, you're at close to 25%. And by your late 30s here, you know, we're down to below 15%, getting close to 10%, and by 40, we are going down this way. So this does not mean it's impossible to conceive and get pregnant here. It just means that it may be a little bit more challenging. So what do you do if you come to see us and because you've had trouble getting pregnant? What are we going to do? Well, we're going to take a history and physical and go through a lot of the things that are risk factors for infertility. And then we'll tailor your evaluation to things that we hear or see on your history and physical that make us more concerned about one of the etiologies for infertility. So the biggest causes of infertility, I look at it kind of in three categories. And I'm going to get this. So the first is the ovary. And the second is the plumbing, or the fallopian tubes in the uterus. And the third is the male, which we'll come to in a minute. So for the ovaries, are you ovulating, and is it a good quality egg? And there's some very simple tests that we can do to figure that out. The second question is, are the fallopian tubes open and allowing the sperm to swim up and out to meet the egg here, fertilize the egg, and be able to go back and implant here in the uterus? And so there's another few quick tests and easy tests that we can do to check out the health of the uterus and the fallopian tubes. And then lastly, the male part. So men are notorious for not coming in with female partners or agreeing to be evaluated. And the fact is men contribute in about a third of the cases to infertility. So that's not insignificant. So the male part is something to not be discounted. It is a very quick test to check out the male factor here, and very important. So myths of male reproduction, so more sex is better, simply not true. In terms of timing intercourse to conceive, it's actually the few days before ovulation are the best bang for your buck in terms of becoming pregnant. Intercourse after ovulation has occurred will not make you pregnant. Boxers versus briefs, no difference, doesn't matter. And then men will say, well, I'm fine. You know, I have children from before. I have a great sex drive. I don't have, erectile dysfunction. But the most manly man walking down the street may actually have very low sperm counts. So that is not a very good surrogate for the male part of things. And then health and age doesn't matter. So male infertility does increase the older a man gets, but it's really not until the 50s. So men do have a few extra years of reproduction compared to women. But their health does matter. So we do see that male factor does increase with obesity, diabetes, neurologic conditions, all of those things. Again, men contribute 20 to 40% of the time. So it is frustrating to us when the men don't come in with their partners or don't want to be checked out because we place the female through a round of testing and it's only fair to go ahead and evaluate the male before we get too involved with things. So after we've evaluated you, we tailor the treatment towards what's right for you based on your diagnosis and also what's right for you guys as a couple. So usually there's a spectrum of treatments that are appropriate and we will tell you what the chance for success is based on what your diagnosis is based on the different treatments. And then you guys talk about it as a couple and decide what's right for you, and then we tailor treatment to you as a couple. IVF is not for everyone, and in fact it's very few people is IVF appropriate for, and so this is the in vitro fertilization or the test tube baby, which you'll hear about. So very few of our couples actually need IVF. We usually can be successful with much less aggressive treatments. IVF is great though for couples who have male factor infertility or who have problems with the fallopian tubes, and IVF is wonderful treatment for those couples and for those who have failed simpler therapies. Additionally, for that genetic testing we talked about in the beginning, couples that harbor a mutation or carry a condition that they would like to avoid passing on to their child, we can offer them in vitro with testing to avoid having a child that's affected. The biggest thing that we do is counseling. We talk a lot in my office. We go through your history and physical in detail, and then spend a lot of time talking about what's going on and what we think we can do to overcome it. And then we listen to you and listen to you guys as a couple tell us what sounds right for you. And additionally, another thing that we do the most of is ovulation induction. So women that don't ovulate regularly, there are very simple things we can do to help them ovulate and become pregnant. We do surgery to fix things like fibroids and polyps and endometriosis, and then congenital problems with the uterus that may be causing infertility or recurrent miscarriage. We offer insemination in times when it's appropriate, and then of course we do IVF genetic testing, and then donor egg IVF for those women who have reached the end of their reproductive life in terms of their ovarian health. And what is our goal with treatment? So our goal is not necessarily pregnancy at any cost. Our goal is to give each couple the best chance to build their family in a way that's acceptable to them. So some of our couples come in and they say to us right off the bat, we're willing to do this, this, and this, but we're not willing to go to this length. And so we help them as best as we can and hopefully are successful along the way. But our goal is not pregnancy at all costs. We do recommend one baby at a time. And so a lot of concerns that couples have, because they won't even come see us, is they're concerned that they'll end up with multiples or three and four babies. And that is simply not our goal. We want a healthy baby and a healthy mom. And so our goal is to get you to 9 months of pregnancy with one baby that goes home with you and doesn't have to go to the intensive care unit. And that's best accomplished with one baby at a time. This is my team, and I'm really proud of my team. Dr. Bates is the division director. This is Dr. Blackwell. He's been around for a while. We call him Professor. This is Dr. Botnight, who looks a lot like me, and we both chose to wear blue. But she is smiling, and I am not, and I don't know why I'm not smiling, but I'm not. This is Dr. Edmonds. He is our embryologist, so he takes care of our embryos and the eggs and the sperm that we have, and he's amazing. And these are our three fellows. So our team does a great job. Dr. Bates actually led our transition to a brand new embryology lab a couple years ago, and we've had great success with IVF. For our couples that do need IVF, you need to choose a center that has a state-of-the-art embryology lab, because that's really where results boil down to. So we're really proud of what we've done at UAB. We're really proud of our success rates, and we've helped a whole lot of couples. I ran into a couple at the pediatrician's office the other day, and they had their little ones with them, and it's just amazing to see them go from the beginning to the end and see the smiles that those children bring them. These are two resources I'd like to recommend, resolve.org and asrm.org. There's a lot of patient information out there, and also SART, S-A-R-T, is kind of the IVF guru. They keep up to date with all of the clinic success rates, and so that's a place that I would encourage you to go if you need IVF. And with that, I will turn it over to Dr. Weta.
So I'm Louisa Weta. I work in the Division of Maternal Fetal Medicine at UAB. So we specialize in managing high-risk pregnancies. So I'm just going to talk a little bit about, we've gone over what to do before you get pregnant and what to do if you have trouble getting pregnant. So I tried to just sort of incorporate some common pregnancy questions that I'm here. So, and then we can go over just some general sort of pregnancy complications and things that I deal with and things that our department can help people with. So an important thing to remember is that healthy women with an uncomplicated pregnancy are usually considered to be low risk. And the majority of pregnancies are low risk. Some problems that we encounter during pregnancy are pretty common, and we have things that we can do to fix them or prevent them. There are some things that are more uncommon and things that we can't necessarily prevent or predict. And these are things that my group specializes in, and you might have to at some point see us, but hopefully not. So these are just some of the common questions that we get about pregnancy and some of the things I thought the myths I'd dispel about these things. So one is I get commonly asked about vaginal bleeding during pregnancy. If you have bleeding during pregnancy, does it mean you're going to miscarry? I also get a lot of questions about nausea, vomiting, how long it's going to last, is it going to go away? And then a common one is people tell you you're eating for two, right? You can eat whatever you want because you're eating for two. That's not always true, so we'll go over that. And another common question is, will I have to have a C-section? And sort of we'll go over indications for a C-section. So bleeding in pregnancy is extremely common, and up to 50% of women in pregnancy will have bleeding at some point during the pregnancy. So although if you have bleeding, especially during the first trimester, it may be a sign of a miscarriage, most of the time it's benign, it does not cause any problems. So the cause of bleeding during pregnancy really depends on when it occurs during pregnancy. So in the first trimester, oftentimes there can just be a bleed right around the gestational sac. Most of the time it resolves on its own, it doesn't cause any problems. In the second and third trimester, bleeding may be related to the position of your placenta or related to preterm labor. So But again, the majority of time, if it's just mild and spotting, it really does not cause any adverse outcomes to the pregnancy. So your doctor will perform a complete exam on you, will evaluate your cervix, make sure there's no evidence of early labor. And we'll also do an ultrasound, make sure the baby's heart rate looks okay, check the position of your placenta, and then check to see, oftentimes we can see a bleed around the sac if there is one, and that's called a subchorionic hemorrhage. As far as nausea, vomiting, and pregnancy, this is also very common. About 50 to 80% of women will experience nausea and vomiting during pregnancy. It's related to some of the changes that occur with pregnancy hormones. Women are more likely to have reflux that contributes to the nausea and vomiting as well. So the term morning sickness is very misleading because the nausea, vomiting, and pregnancy doesn't just happen in the morning. It can actually happen at any time throughout the day. So it's called morning sickness, but doesn't have to occur right when you get up. Usually starts to subside once you get out of the first trimester. Certainly by about 18 weeks, we notice that patients really have a decrease in their nausea and vomiting. But every now and then, we do have some patients that may struggle with it throughout their pregnancy. The severe form is called hyperemesis gravidarum. This is what Princess Kate has, if you guys hear about her and why she's been hospitalized. This is a very severe form of nausea vomiting. It's pretty uncommon. Less than 1% of pregnancies will actually have this. And this is where you can have significant dehydration and weight loss. Usually you may require IV fluids and hospitalization, that sort of thing. So what can your doctor give you to help you, or what can you do to help with the nausea vomiting of pregnancy? So eat smaller meals, so I just tell my patients to eat small, frequent meals throughout the day. Don't try and eat just huge portions at a time. Eat prior to getting up in the morning actually helps, so I tell patients to put some saltine crackers by the bedside and just try and take a few bites of that before they get out of bed. That'll help with some of the nausea. And then eat sort of bland, low-fat, or high-protein foods. I had a patient today, actually, she was 18 weeks, and she's had nausea vomiting. She said she was having nausea vomiting in the car on the way to see us today. We did an ultrasound, everything was fine, and she said she was headed to Milo's. So it's just, you know, if you're having problems with nausea vomiting, just be careful about what you're eating and stick with things that are bland. Don't go for the fried, spicy food, that sort of thing, because that's only going to exacerbate the problem. So if you're struggling with nausea and vomiting, avoid cigarette smoke and sort of offensive kitchen odor. So some people will say that certain foods will sort of trigger their nausea and vomiting. If sort of just dietary changes don't work, there are medications that your physician can prescribe you. They're called antiemetics, and they can help with the nausea. Ginger actually helps with nausea, and then vitamins. So actually vitamin B6 will often prescribe. Take it 3 times a day, it actually helps with nausea and vomiting. And then medications for acid reflux as well, because that's a big problem, a contributor to nausea and vomiting of pregnancy. So weight gain in pregnancy, this is also a common question I get. We know through studies that if you optimize how much weight you gain in pregnancy, you decrease your risk of having an adverse pregnancy outcome. So we know women who gain too little weight during pregnancy may be at increased risk for preterm birth or having an infant that is of low birth weight. And then on the other side, we know that women who gain too much weight during pregnancy are at increased risk for things like diabetes, high blood pressure. There's an increased risk of having to have a C-section, an increased risk of having a baby that's of larger birth weight. And actually, some studies have suggested that if you gain too much weight during pregnancy, your child may be predisposed to obesity in childhood. So it's important to sort of keep your weight gain within the recommended range, and I have a slide on that next. So things you can do to keep your weight gain reasonable is obviously eat a healthy diet. Exercise, I get a lot of common questions about exercise in pregnancy, and actually the American College of OBGYNs does recommend that you exercise in pregnancy, so 30 minutes a day, most days of the week, actually. And so you can really exercise at the level that you did prior to pregnancy, as long as you're healthy and you have no medical or obstetrical contraindications to exercise. So we don't recommend that you take up marathon running if you haven't previously done that, but if you were a runner before pregnancy and you're healthy and you feel great, you can actually continue to run throughout pregnancy. So obviously if you develop any problems with preterm labor, that sort of thing, we may modify your activity, but other than that, it's perfectly safe to exercise. You just want to avoid activities that may predispose you to things like abdominal trauma. But you want to watch how much fruit, vegetables that you take in with your diet, and then like Dr. Arbuckle said, a multivitamin with folic acid is important. So these are our guidelines for weight gain during pregnancy, and it really, the weight gain recommendations differ on what your body mass index or your BMI is. And to calculate your BMI, it's your weight in kilograms divided by your height in meters squared. And so you can see in women who are underweight, we recommend a little bit more weight gain, 28 to 40 pounds. Normal weight women, 25 to 35 pounds throughout the pregnancy. And so this is where eating for two kind of comes in. You're eating for two, and you do need to increase in the amount of calories you take in during pregnancy, but you shouldn't just eat whatever you want now just because you're pregnant. So, and most of the weight gain is going to come in the second and third trimesters. So really during the first trimester, the weight gain is actually minimal. Really most women only about 5 pounds or so. And then for the throughout the second and third trimester, the recommended weight gain is about a pound per week. So. And like I said, keeping within this range will really minimize some of your risk for pregnancy complications. I also commonly get asked about C-sections and why you might have to have one. So these are the most common reasons why you might have to have a C-section. We all recommend vaginal delivery. We always counsel women that vaginal delivery is preferable, especially if you think you want to have multiple children. We know that the more C-sections you have, the greater the risk of things like scar tissue and that sort of thing. So really do advocate a vaginal delivery unless there's an indication to have a C-section. So some women, they just don't dilate, so their labor stalls out and they have to have a C-section. If the baby's heart rate goes down, we're seeing decelerations or drops in the baby's heartbeat during labor and we're concerned about it, we may have to perform a C-section for that reason. If the baby isn't head down, so if the baby's breech, so feet first, that's an indication for a C-section. If there's a problem with your placenta, so placenta previa, the placenta is covering the cervix, those women need to have a C-section. If your baby's too large or too small, you might have to have a C-section. And then if you have more than one baby, so not all women with twins have to have a C-section depending on how the babies are presenting, but if you have triplets, then you'll have to have a C-section. And then I also get asked, if you've had one C-section, does it mean that you have to always have a C-section? And the answer is most of the time no, but it really depends on what type of C-section you had. So patients will commonly say, you can have a trial of labor after a C-section depending on what the scar is on your uterus, and people will look at the scar on their abdomen and say, well, my incision went horizontal. Well, the incision on the outside doesn't really tell us much about what type of incision we had to make on your uterus. So if women who've had a very early delivery, they may have had something called a classical C-section, and that's where we have to make an incision up and down or vertically on your uterus, and we have to go through the muscular portion of the uterus. And with those women, we don't recommend that they labor in a subsequent pregnancy because there is a risk of complications with labor. So for those women who've had what's called a classical C-section, you always have to have another C-section. But if you've had what we call a low transverse C-section, and this is what's most commonly performed, especially if you have a term baby, it's in the lower part of the uterus where there's not a lot of muscular tissue, and so really it's safe to labor in future pregnancies because there's a less than 1% chance of having a complication. So it is safe to have a vaginal birth after a C-section, but this is something you should always discuss with your physician because every physician and hospital has a different policy about that. But at UAB, we definitely encourage women, if they're good candidates for a vaginal delivery, to have one. So. And really the women who are best candidates for having a trial of a labor after a C-section are women who had a C-section because the baby was feet first or the baby's heart rate went down. The women who sort of stalled out at 6 or 7 centimeters, there's a good chance that that could happen again in a future pregnancy. So that may decrease your risk of having a successful vaginal delivery. These are some of the more common complications that I see, and they're hard to describe in just a few minutes, but I thought we'd just talk briefly about each of these because these are things that you might experience during pregnancy. So gestational diabetes. So every pregnant woman will get glucose testing about 24 to 28 weeks. So you hear about women drinking sort of that sugary substance. They'll tell you it tastes like, what's that orange cola, Orange Crush, but it doesn't really, it's not that good. So they'll have you drink that and then we'll test your blood sugar about an hour after that. And we have certain cutoffs that we use. If you're above our cutoff, we'll actually make you drink it again and test your blood sugars every 3 hours, or for 3 hours after that. If you fail that test, then you may be labeled as having gestational diabetes, which doesn't mean that you have diabetes outside of pregnancy, it just means that you have diabetes in pregnancy. And so patients will say, oh no, I don't want to take insulin, I don't want to do injections. Well, it's important to remember that just because you fail the blood sugar test and you have gestational diabetes doesn't mean you're automatically going to be put on insulin. We first try dietary modifications, so following a diabetic diet. If diet modifications fail, then we actually have medication you can take by mouth, or oral medication that you can take. And it's only after you fail those things that you may have to be placed on insulin. As far as preterm labor, well, we know that a term pregnancy is any pregnancy that's delivered after 37 weeks of gestation, though we know the optimal time for a baby to be born is about 39 to 40 weeks. But anything after 37 weeks is considered full term. So preterm birth is less than 37 weeks, and preterm labor is defined as contractions that cause your cervix to dilate less than 37 weeks. As far as how we manage it, it really depends on how far along you are in pregnancy. So if you're early in pregnancy, 28, 30 weeks, you'll likely require admission to the hospital. We might give you fluids through your IV and something called a tocolytic, which just is a medication to try and stop your contractions. So a lot of patients ask about bed rest. So bed rest has actually not been proven to help decrease the incidence of preterm birth. So we like to prescribe something called modified bed rest. So we don't commit a woman to laying in bed and not moving, because we know with pregnancy you're at an increased risk for blood clots, and we don't want you just laying on the couch and doing nothing all day long. So what we prescribe is something called modified bed rest, where you're off of your feet for most of the time during the day. You're not doing heavy lifting, you're not doing that sort of thing. But rarely is bed rest sort of the answer to preventing preterm labor. As far as blood pressure complications, there's several different categories of blood pressure complications. Gestational hypertension is blood pressure that develops after 20 weeks of pregnancy in someone who's never had elevated blood pressure going into pregnancy. And then something that's a little bit more severe is something called preeclampsia. And with this, you have elevated blood pressure, and then you're also spilling protein in your urine. And the way we check for that is we collect your urine for 24 hours and measure the amount of protein in it. And really how we manage your pregnancy if you have blood pressure complications really depends on how far along you are, how severe your blood pressure is, and how you and your baby are doing at that time. And we hope none of you guys would ever have any problems with blood pressure. So a lot of people ask, you know, what constitutes a high-risk pregnancy, or what would make me high-risk? So women who are considered high-risk may have certain medical conditions. So we know women with diabetes, high blood pressure outside of pregnancy, and thyroid disease are at increased risk for having pregnancy complications and may be considered high risk. If you have, in a current pregnancy, your baby's been diagnosed with a birth defect, or your baby is growing too small, or you've had a problem with preterm labor, that would make your pregnancy high risk. If you have a history of a preterm birth in a prior pregnancy, or you've had preeclampsia in a prior pregnancy, that would make your next pregnancy high risk. And then if you're carrying twins or triplets, that definitely makes you a high-risk pregnancy because of the increased risk of preterm birth, blood pressure issues, diabetes, that sort of thing. And so women who are considered high-risk may be referred to my group, and we are MFMs, and we specialize in managing these high-risk pregnancies. So we have several services that we offer, and one that we offer that a lot of people don't know about is preconception counseling. So we actually will see patients in our office before they get pregnant and talk, review their medical complications, their medications, and sort of what they can do. We counsel women on what they can do to sort of optimize their medical condition prior to achieving a pregnancy to really decrease the risk of having any problems during pregnancy. So we see women with diabetes, high blood pressure, thyroid disease, and that's really a service that we provide. We also provide genetic screening. We do ultrasound diagnosis for things like if your doctor office saw something on a routine ultrasound that they were concerned about, they may refer you to us to sort of take a closer look at the baby to see if we agree or see something that we're concerned about. We make recommendations. Physicians will send us patients to just for us to make recommendations on what to do with them during pregnancy. And then we manage higher order multiples, so twins, triplets, quads, that's sort of thing. So we also will manage babies that we know have birth defects. A lot of those babies have to be delivered at UAB. Certain babies would have heart defects and that sort of thing. So we will follow those babies throughout pregnancy. And then, like we talked about before, we'll also take care of women who have certain health problems. So women who have cardiac disease, asthma, endocrine problems, that sort of thing. So these are women who have very complicated medical conditions that may not have ever thought pregnancy was possible for them. We actually help these women throughout pregnancy. And so as far as what you can do to minimize your risk of having pregnancy complications, so obviously following a healthy diet, taking your vitamin, exercising, avoiding tobacco, alcohol, drug use. Keep your gestational weight gain within the optimal range for your body weight. Keep your regular appointments with your OBGYN, and then ask questions. So I have patients all the time who apologize when they come into my office with a list of questions, and really, that's what your provider is there for. I think most of us do our jobs because we love what we do. And so I never want to have a patient apologize to me for asking questions. So don't be afraid to ask your provider if you're concerned about something. And then the last thing is just enjoy your pregnancy. It's such a special time. It's an amazing experience. And I know the three of us here, we all have children. And it's just a very, very special time in your life. And so we want you to enjoy it. So that's it.